Good evening, everyone. I'm joined here with Anthony Mickels. He lives in the Netherlands. So he started the Gelray, which is the first regional currency in the Netherlands. Well, it's nice having you on the show. Can you please explain, when did you get the idea to start that, and when did you sort of woke up about the monetary system?
Okay, well, thanks, Robert, for having me on the show tonight. Well, the reason I started it is because I did indeed awaken to the monetary problems that we are facing, and this was maybe 2005, 2006, because I started to realize that banking is a scam and fractional reserve banking, usury, etc. I started to look for alternatives and started developing alternatives, and that is the Gelre.
So how does this work? There's different ideas going about monetary reform. One of them is social credit. So is it a private enterprise, or does it involve the government?
Well, that's a very basic issue, whether it's government sponsored or private. And social credit usually is associated with governments, and governments printing the money and handing the cash out to the populace and for them to spend it in circulation. But my unit is completely private and is based on what is called mutual credit. So like a let system, people can go into debt, the credit results into money circulating. It's a very different system. It's a little bit difficult to explain if you're a novice to this, but social credit is a debt-free monetary system. The government just prints cash, $1, or without a debt ever being to repay, so the money never has to be repaid. But in the case of mutual credit, people go into debt, and this debt starts to circulate as a currency.
So do you make a profit?
Well, I would like to, but I would need more participants. The issue is that over the last few years, a few years ago, my system was shut down by the central bank. And since then, I've been working on a new system with new parameters and new rules. But we're still busy programming the software for this.
So it's based on the idea of barters.
Yeah, basically true. Yeah, that's right. Most barters work on mutual credit.
So you explain this in detail. Every participant is given an account and credit. You give an example, one unit equals $1.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's the basic idea. You, for instance, you're a new business, and you sign up for the network, and you get an account, and you get a credit line. Say, and you say, okay, one gelre is 1 euro, and you get a credit line for 1,000 gelre or 5,000 gelre, depending on the size of your business or on your collateral. You can start spending this credit. If you use this 1,000 gelre, that your credit line of 1,000 gelre, you use to pay this with your suppliers, he gets this 1,000 gelre. It's always a zero-sum game. So when the new business goes into debt and he starts paying with the gelre, the amount of gelre that is in circulation is always the same as the total amount of debt outstanding. And when all debts are repaid, there is no gelre left in circulation. That's basically how it works.
So, with the debt, they just pay a one-time fee. There's no interest.
Exactly. And most people realize nowadays that in modern banking, all the money that is being lent out is being created. The money it is the moment the loan is being taken out, and this is fractional reserve banking. So this credit creation is really very cheap. It's basically a computer program, and that's all it takes. And but when you start to consider the amount of money that we pay for this credit, I mean, if you take out a mortgage for $200,000, after 30 years you may have paid $300,000 in interest and $200,000 for the principal. So a $200,000 home actually costs $500,000. Whereas this credit has been created, with just a computer, pressing some computer buttons, and this makes banking an incredibly lucrative business, and this also shows that this credit should actually cost basically very little, and managing a loan over 30 years, especially when there is a collateral like a house, in the case of a mortgage, well, it should cost a few thousand euros and not much more.
So zero reserves are required.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. That's another issue, because in the case of fractional reserve banking, not only do they create the credit out of nothing and they rake in all these hundreds of thousands of dollars for a few hundred thousand dollar mortgage, but then they don't have the money backing the credit that is circulating, and banks tend to go bust once in a while, and this happens every few years, and then the taxpayer has to cough up billions of dollars to mend the damage they've done themselves. This fractional reserve banking is intrinsically very unstable. So with mutual credit, there are no reserves, and the bank is never, the mutual credit facility, which we call a bank, is never short of cash or never short of reserves, because there are no reserves. So there's no instability. There's always as much debt outstanding as there are units in circulation. And this is a zero-sum game, and nothing can go wrong. It's intrinsically stable.
So you were talking about what you were involved with as a private, but you said that the government can also do that using mutual credit on a local level. I know there's also, I've interviewed some people from the Public Banking Institute. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, sure. That's Ellen Brown's initiative.
Yeah, I interviewed Ellen Brown. So is that having a mutual credit on the government running mutual credit, would that be how would that be different than public banking?
Well, public banking is based on the current fractional reserve banking system, but nonetheless, I mean, if done well, even fractional reserve banking would be stable. It's just the fact that that the banking syndicate is run by complete maniacs who don't care anything about the public interest, and in fact have interests very different from the public interest. So if you would have public banks, they wouldn't go bust either, even though they're based on fractional reserve banking. So it's probably pretty similar, although I think it's fair to say that public banking is not interest-free, and I take issue with that. I mean, if credit is so incredibly cheap to offer, it should be interest-free, but basically it's the same idea, to have credit created out of nothing and do it in the public interest instead of in the interest of a private banking cartel.
You write about serious usurpation and how the poorest 80% are paying interest to the richest 10%.
That's right, yeah. That's a very serious issue, and that's what basically drives me, and this is what has been established by Margaret Kennedy. Most people don't realize that interest is a wealth transfer from the poor to the rich, per definition. Once you start to get about it, once you start to think about it, it's immediately clear, because people that have money, they own the banks, so they lend out the money, and people that don't have money, they have to go into debt, so they are the ones paying interest. And this has been quantified by Margaret Kennedy, a German economist, and she has established that the poorest 80 pay more interest than they receive to the richest 10%, and the next richest 10% pay as much interest as they receive. This wealth transfer goes on also within the top 10% bracket. So within the top 10%, the poorest 8% pay more interest than they receive to the richest 1%. And even in the top 1%, this continues. So the richest, so the poorest 0.8% pay interest to the 0.1, richest 0.1%, and what it all comes down to is that eventually all the interest ends up at the absolute top of the food chain. It takes time, and it takes maybe decades, but eventually all the money ends up with the ultra rich.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the goal of monetary reform. What it should be is to liberate people from the slavery to the money power.
Absolutely.
And you talk about how this kind of small plutocracy, how everyone has sort of you describe it as a food chain.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you get this idea of a wealth transfer and with the percentages that I've just been explaining, I mean, it is a food chain, and you have a few barracudas at the absolute top, and these are the well-known usual suspects, the Rothschilds and the Warburgs and what have you. And this has been documented for ages. I don't think anybody who has a clear perspective on real history can take issue with that. The international bankers, etc., they've been around for ages, and well, that's where all the money goes.
So on the government level, the government creates the currency monopoly with the legal tender laws, and it hands it over to the monopoly and the private central banking cartel,
yeah,
destroying us with interest.
Very good, yeah. That's the issue, and you have the libertarians, and they explain, well, it's all a government operation. It's not. I mean, the government, they could print the money themselves interest-free. History also shows that if the government maintains its own legal tender monopoly, that it will print the money interest-free, but since they hand it over to the private banking cartel, that's where the interest comes from.
It's interesting you bring up the libertarians. You're very critical of libertarians and the Austrian economist. I'd like to get to that a little bit more detail after the break, but I'll continue with the goals of monetary reform. So in the market, then you have the privately controlled interest-free currencies, which are designed to fully function high-powered means of exchange.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. And the problem, of course, is that governments around the world, around the globe, have been subverted by the international banking cartel, by the money power. And you have basically two strains of thought when it comes to monetary reform. The classical American populist reform focuses on government-level reform. So basically, the classic line would be a greenback kind of thing, comparable to what Denis Kucinich is now proposing. So the government prints its own money debt-free, interest-free. This in itself, I can go along with for a long way. I can go along with that, but the problem is that not only is the United States government is probably not... not quite the sugar daddy that we would like it to be. I mean, if the money power wouldn't be around the American public...
That is your big criticism of the public banking or social credit. You think it relies too much on the government. But you're also, as you said, critical of the libertarians at the same time. You're advocating an alternative that's different than what they both advocate.
Yeah. The issue should be decentralization of power. And mind you, I am far more in favor of social credit, even though it is a government created. But the social credit is decentralized because the money is handed out to the populace. The newly created cash is handed out to the populace to be spent into circulation. So the purchasing power is with the people, instead of the government. So this implies a drastic and major decentralization of power, and that is why I do support social credit. But I do not support the greenback, because it would imply a very strong... It's a very, very attractive proposition for government.
So how is the greenback different than social credit?
Because the greenback and the social credit, they're alike in the sense that it's a debt-free unit and it's created by government. That's what they have in common. But the greenback is spent into circulation by the government, so the government can buy whatever it likes with it. It usually buys two kinds of things, infrastructure or war. And social credit is spent...
A good point you bring up, because a lot of people... praise Lincoln for the greenbacks, but there was probably a correlation between the greenbacks and the Civil War.
Yeah, very much so. And I used to think that most people in the interest-free community have a favor Lincoln and consider him to be a good guy. But I have very grave doubts about that. I mean, Lincoln did supervise a very major war, and it did result in a major centralization of power and a major strengthening of the U.S. federal government. It resulted in, mayhem in the South, and it ended a lot of state rights, so I'm not too sure about overrating Lincoln. And the Greenback, and not only the Greenback, but also the Continental, George Washington's Continental, was printed to get the British of the American homeland. And the Chinese emperors, they finance all sorts of aggressive campaigns with their debt-free units. So I'm not too sure about government-created debt-free units spent by the government themselves. And especially if you look at the U.S. government, which is associated with a massive empire, the likes of which the world has never seen. And why give them a debt-free unit so they can buy even more stealth fighters or even more colonized space even more quickly? And I don't know. Better create it like a social credit and hand it over to people, and the people will buy normal stuff with it that actually enhances life.
So what money should be, it should be a means of exchange, not a store of value.
That's quite crucial, yeah, that's quite crucial. I mean, most modern economists, either Austrian or mainstream, believe that money is a store of value and a means of exchange, but it's quite clear that these two functions are opposing each other, because storing value and paying, well, that's a thesis and antithesis. To pay is to circulate, to store is to hoard, is to end circulation. And you can have either a good means of exchange or a good store of value. And saying that the modern economists say, well, people, it must be a stable store of value, otherwise people won't accept it. But it's the other way around. By losing value, if a unit loses value, people will be have a strong incentive to spend it quickly. And it transpires that the paying party takes precedence over the accepting party. So a business will have a very strong incentive to accept the units that his customers want to pay with. And that's why a unit must be a means of exchange, and it's not so important that it's a good store of value. In fact, if it loses value, for instance, when there is inflation, or you also have Gresham's Law, when you have a solid unit and a depreciating unit, you see that the depreciating unit is a stronger means of exchange. So, and money should be a means of exchange.
So, your writing on the interest, what was interesting you point out is that the debate is dominated by Americans. You point out the films The Zeitgeist and The Money Masters, and books such as Money. Well, that's known as a movie, Money is Debt. And also Thomas Greco and Ellen Brown, and they've made an enormous contribution, you said, to your awakening and the awakening of a lot of people. But you think there's been a lot less going on in Europe, but you do point out there are some examples in European history. You point out the economists Gottfried Feder, Helmut Kreutz, and Silvio Gesell.
Yeah,
and the current standard bearer, Margaret Kennedy.
Yeah, that's. I'm in the Netherlands. I'm in Arnhem. Yeah, from a bridge too far, the Battle of Arnhem, and that's only maybe 10 or 15 miles from the German border. And all the news that I get here, I mean, I've been involved with the truth movement and the alternative media since I think 2003 or so. And over the last few years, you see that in Western Europe there are coming available better sites that offer good information. But even today that it's quite clear that their information is based on what is developed in the United States, what's being created in the United States, and all the leading writers on the conspiracy or creating credible opposition against the status quo is all coming from the United States, except for the usury issue, because that's also why I think Austrian economics and libertarianism is strong in the United States, because the understanding of interest is probably not as clear as it is in Europe, and Europe has seen an anti-usury tradition, culminating eventually in Nazism, and also destroyed by the destruction of Nazism, destroyed by guilt by through association, because that is what happened. Before the Second World War, you had these German economists like Gottfried Feder, but with the destruction of Hitler, anti-usury activism became equated with anti-Semitism, and well.
Yeah, that's one of my guests. I forget which guest it was, but they were talking about. One of the guests who was talking about social credit, one of the reasons the social credit movement was destroyed after World War II is because it was equated with fascism. And you've also kind of written about that. Is anti-usury activism anti-Semitic, how it's sort of, or people say it's fascism. And I also brought up in the book Liberal Fascism by the neocon Jonah Goldberg. He tries to say that, like, someone like Father Coughlin is a leftist because he was anti-banker, anti-usury. But could you go into more detail about Gottfried Feder and some of his economic policies in National Socialist Germany?
Well, it's quite clear. I mean, he wrote a book, Breaking the Shackles of Interest, and Hitler went on to exclaim at various major speeches. You've seen the films from the time with hundreds of thousands of people clamoring, clapping for him, and the mass psychosis that he managed to create. And during these meetings, he'd explained that breaking the thraldom of interest is the kernel of National Socialism, and throughout the ages, the conflict between Jews and local native Christian communities has always centered around usury, and that's also why a man like Ezra Pound, why he wrote a lot about usura being the money power, and why he went to Italy and spent a lot of time there. Making radio shows, explaining to the public why fascism was a culmination of an age-old battle. And this is what it's all about. And Gottfried Feder, he wrote this book, Breaking the Thraldom of Interest, and he also created a manifesto, which was published, I think, in 1921. And this manifesto is a 20-point program, and I think it's fair to say that if Occupy Wall Street would take over this program as a 0.9 version, instead of Reichsbank, write a Federal Reserve Bank, they would have a manifesto that would be ready for the 21st century. The same basic issues are still at hand. The money is created by the banks out of nothing, and we are enslaved through usury.
You mentioned Occupy Wall Street, and one thing that's interesting about that is we used to have in this from the 19th century to the early 20th century sort of a strong populist movement, and you mentioned people like Ezra Pound. One thing that happened after World War II is we really sort of broke up into this sort of phony left-right paradigm, and I kind of see that with the Occupy Wall Street versus the Tea Party, with one side being sort of the kind of phony conservative libertarians who say that government intervention in the economy is the sole problem, and that the bank they don't really, a lot of them don't even say that much about the private bankers that I'm talking about. Well, you talk the Ron Paul supporters, you're critical of them, but they're set. I wouldn't put them in the same category with the mainstream Tea Party types. But then you sort of have the leftists, a lot of the leftists in Occupy Wall Street, And what it kind of shows is we don't really have any kind of a real populist movement. Maybe Europe is different, but I'm just looking at the United States.
Well, Europe is not different, and the United States is still the forefront of opposition against the money power, and everything that happens in the United States is...
What about the... I gotta say about... You mentioned Europe. Some of the nationalist parties in Europe, like the Golden Dawn in Greece, seem pretty... Aren't they pretty anti-usury or anti-banker?
Well, no, not really, because they're most definitely not against usury. There is no credible party in Europe that even mentions usury. Of course, Golden Dawn is just a completely fake controlled opposition kind of party that so-called neo-Nazi blah blah. Even its name, Golden Dawn. I mean, let's face it, that's the name of the satanic lodges that Aleister Crowley created in Great Britain in the early 20th century. So it's a complete fake, complete controlled opposition, and absolutely. There's no control, no uncontrolled, credible, anti-usury, anti-bank organization in Europe whatsoever.
That is a pretty strong allegation to make about the European nationalist movements, because there are a lot of people out there who support them and are optimistic about them. Could you please give some specific examples why you think they're sort of controlled opposition?
Well, I'm oh man, I mean... For instance, the so-called socialists that, not even the Golden Dawn guys, but the, I forget his name, it's a Greek name, it's difficult for me also, but the guys that were so-called threatening to win the elections last weekend, what they were actually suggesting was to hire expensive public servants and pay them wages comparable to those of pre-crisis levels. And in this way, force the European Union's hand and kick Greece out of the European Union. Well, whereas it is absolutely clear that before the crisis, you had a bloated public sector in Greece with a privileged public servant class, which was basically exploiting the masses already. And of course, this eventually led to massive deficits on the government level, and this is what, well, on a superficial level, created the problems that we're dealing with now. But if these people were genuine, if they wanted some real reform, they of course would be suggesting, well, let's start wrestling with some bankers. Let's get rid of the European Union ourselves. Let's create debt-free money, or at least create interest-free credit, and go along this way. But this is absolutely not the case, and the program that I've been describing just yet is completely outrageous and ridiculous, and it's just making a fool of the people. And the only reason why they gained popularity is because they were anti-austerity, and that is what Greece is suffering from now big time. But people are just going in a blind alley in this way, in a very typical money power fashion.
So you really go into detail about the libertarians and the Austrian economist. Their main premise is that we need the gold standard. That's sort of their solution to things. Do you really have a pretty long expose on them?
Yeah.
Is that the one you call faux economics?
Yeah, that's right. That's faux economics. Austrian economics is faux economics, and Austrian economics exists to usurp the traditional American populist movement. And you see that. You just described the phony left-right paradigm, which is now morphing into a Tea Party versus Occupy Wall Street. We're Occupy Wall Street on the left, and the Tea Party on the right, and the extreme right, you might say, is libertarianism and hardcore Austrian economics with its gold standard. And this is complete faux economics, because gold, as anybody with even basic grasp of history should understand, has been a completely controlled unit, completely controlled currency for ages and ages. And the international banking cartel has controlled gold for centuries, and it's very easy to understand immediately that gold is completely worthless as a means of exchange if you understand usury and the fact that the money power controls all the gold and lends it into circulation at interest. And if you see that, you immediately realize that it doesn't make much difference whether we pay all the interest in gold coins or in Fed notes. We still pay $300,000 interest over $200,000 loan over 30 years, and so that nothing changes, and we pay our tribute in gold coins instead of in paper, and, well, that's all.
Yeah, that's the thing with the libertarians as well. I notice, like, you see a lot of libertarian economists, they allow onto Fox News, and I think it's sort of a safety valve where the powers that be are tolerating the libertarians to prevent a real populist movement from taking ground.
I think it's fair to say that we can take it a step further. The money power has created libertarianism out of nothing. I have written together with Meme Hunter a number of articles on this issue, and I think we have made it very, very clear and established without a doubt that libertarianism has been created. I think, as of the Second World War and in the years after that, by the powers that be, by importing these Austrians like von Mises and Hayek and making Murray Rothbard important, and we have established very clearly that these libertarian outlets all have been financed by the same people, and that nowadays you have thousands and thousands of libertarian organizations, and if you trace them back where they all came from, they all come from the Volcker Fund, which was established just before the Second World War by some Jewish businessman, and
they have a lot of those libertarian organizations, like they have real big money behind them.
Absolutely, and it's billionaire money. And Meme Hunter, in one of his articles, established that these billionaires can be directly traced back to Bernard Baruch, who was basically Rothschild right hand man and who dominated American politics in the interbellum. And it's absolutely. I think we have established without a doubt that libertarianism was created out of nothing as the right side of the dialectic, because the money power always works with dialectics. So they created Marxism and created all this havoc with that. And as a reaction, they have capitalism, and libertarianism is the far right of capitalism. And so they play this dialectic of the ultra right versus the ultra left, and they own both sides of the conflict. And libertarianism exists and especially Austrian economics exists to dominate the opposition on the right, and especially opposition against the current monetary order. So 100 years ago, you'd have this populist tradition, and they would clamor for debt-free currencies. Nowadays, the populist movement has been usurped by libertarianism and its gold standard.
So you've written about, who is someone named Keith Gardner at this blog called the Liberty Revival blog, and he has this article called Zero Tolerance for Hate Speech.
The basic issue, of course, is that I'm a monetary reformer. I've been in this business for almost 10 years now. And at the end of the day, you can talk forever about interest. You can talk forever about fractional reserve banking. But you face the fact that you are dealing with an international banking cartel, and you face the fact that this international banking cartel is dominated by Jews. And this is the eternal question within the monetary reform movement. Should we point this out or not? And people like Keith Gardner, I mean, I respect Keith. He's done some very powerful work with Liberty Revival, and he's only one man. I mean, you have many people of a similar persuasion, and they say, well, it's just a big accident, and you have power centralization, and you have some ultra-rich guys, and they are behind this, and that's all there is to it. But I don't believe that, and every time I look at the issue, I see Jewish supremacism, and I see that throughout European history there have been tensions between Jews and Christians, and not even between all Jews, because that's nonsense. I mean, most Jews are poor, you know, so it's quite clear that they are being exploited by the same usurious practices as the Christians are. But the fact is that the ultra rich bankers that have been around in Europe forever, throughout the Middle Ages also, these people are Jewish. And yeah, people hate me for saying that, and people hate many people for saying that. And the problem is that
probably don't they have like laws about talking about stuff like that?
Absolutely, yeah. Hate speech, yeah.
But what do you think about how we should tackle this issue? Because there's some, on one hand, you get some people who just want to avoid the issue completely. But then there's some people who talk about the issue nonstop. What do you think is the right way to address it?
Yeah, well, my way of addressing is not denying it when it comes along. And I've made a point of explaining that I do believe that it is, at the end of the day, related to Jewish supremacism. But I don't stress it all the time. And but I do feel that for my own credibility and because you have this truth movement now online, and you have this growing awareness of an international conspiracy going on, and that for my personal credibility, but for the credibility of every real reformer, every real opponent of the current order, I mean, you have to have a position on this. And it's nasty, and at this time of the battle, it probably costs more adherents than it gains. But I'm in this for the long haul and for ultimate victory. And I'm quite positive that along the way, more and more people will start to wake up and start to realize, hey. Something's going on. There's something really fishy. It's not just Zionism, but it's also the international banker clique and the Rothschilds and what have you, and people that have been explaining this for all the way. They will have more credibility.
You talk about Alex Jones, and you talk about Henry Mackow, and you say Alex Jones is a gatekeeper. Do you think Alex Jones does more? Obviously, he does give out false information. But do you think Alex Jones does some good by bringing people as sort of a gatekeeper to these issues?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I mean, because it's not in the hands of those writing; it's in the hands of those reading. And of course, I think it's fair to say that on the one hand, Alex Jones, he hinders the growth of people because they walk into his site and they start reading about libertarianism and about the powers that be instead of international bankers and Jewish international bankers. And the government, of course, because Alex Jones blames everything on government and not on the forces behind government. And but I think at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. People just have their own process of awakening, and it's not in the hands of people writing about it. It's in the hands of people reading.
And the thing about the way Alex Jones explains it, I think he makes it sound more complex. Like when he talks about the whole kind of conspiracy angle, he makes it very... let's see how the best way to describe it. These very kind of elaborate conspiracy theories, I think some of it is kind of a distraction because it's not that complex. I think it's purely about people who have power and want to consolidate their power, and that's been going on. I mean, throughout it's worse today, but it's been going on throughout human history. It's about the conspiracy angles. I think in some ways it makes it more because they want to take what's going on. And they want to make it out into some kind of like the plot of a movie, but it's very. I think I look at it. It's not really not that complex. It's a very simple thing, basically about people just wanting to consolidate their power and rule over others.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And by stressing all these other organizations like the CFR and the Bilderbergers and God only knows what.
Yeah, like he's obsessed. Alex Jones is obsessed with like infiltrating this little group called the Bohemian Grove,
and it's a place
where these elites meet. But I think it's just kind of silly to be obsessed with like some place, this little place, Bohemian Grove. It doesn't really look at the big picture of what's going on.
Exactly. Fair enough. Yeah.
And you wrote about sort of how the bankers control the sort of libertarian versus communist dialect. Yeah. Do you get into the issue of the Cold War? You talk about the John Birch Society, I know.
Yeah, the John Birch Society, of course, was a forerunner of libertarianism, and the Koch brothers were involved in, or the father of the Koch brothers, Fred Koch, was involved in creating the John Birch Society. Another famous John Bircher, of course, was Ed Griffin, who wrote this this atrocious book and this famous book, Creature of Jekyll Island, obscuring the message of Ezra Pound and Eustace Mullins, who wrote this famous book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve. And Ed Griffin basically hijacked this book and explained.
Well, I've read it, so there is a lot. I mean, there is a lot of good information in the book. But you're basically saying that he took the good information from these other people like Eustace Mullins and Ezra Pound and sort of used it to promote sort of libertarianism.
Absolutely, and he explained, yes, the Federal Reserve Bank is a private cartel. That's a good information in the book. But to solve this, we need a gold standard, whereas Ezra Pound and Eustace Mullins were very clear that the gold standard was a complete and utter banker operation, which is blatantly obvious for everybody who has even basic grasp of history. And Eustace Mullins, actually, and Ezra Pound, actually, promoted social credit. And if they'd been living now, and if mutual credit and interest-free credit had been available at the time, they would have been suggesting that road ahead.
So you point out this article by Henry Mackow, and he even says that Joe McCarthy was he thinks Joe McCarthy was also a tool of the bankers.
Yeah, probably, yeah, because he was downplaying the Jewish part of it all, and he eventually got decapitated when he started to realize that everywhere he looked at the communists, most of them were Jewish. Because eventually, at the end of the line, Joe McCarthy started to wake up, just like Kennedy did.
Oh, he woke up later. So they were just sort of, you think they were just kind of using him at first?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Most people who gain that kind of public prominence are being used. Otherwise, they'd be just being downplayed.
So you've been following the current euro crisis, and this ties in with what we were talking about in Greece. What is your take on that?
Well, the basic dynamic of the euro crisis is that there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, we have credit crunches every so many years, and they created monetary union back in the 90s, knowing that there would be disbalances because Northern Europe is more competitive than Southern Europe. And what we had in the first decennium of this millennium is that Germany was in a semi-depression because of the reunification with Eastern Germany, and Southern Europe, especially the pigs, were booming with a real estate bubble. And they had a zero interest, well, almost zero interest economy, whereas they had a real estate bubble, whereas Germany was lagging economically, and that's why there was such a low interest rate. So there was a real estate bubble in Spain, in Ireland, also perhaps maybe not a real estate bubble, but other bubbles in Greece, and these popped. Another basic dynamic was that Spain and the other Southern European nations are less competitive than the German economy, and this leads to a structural capital outflow from the south to the north, and this can only be corrected by handouts from the north to the south. And this is what Germany resists, or at least the German public. But this is just a fact of life. If you have this monetary union, it's the same in the United States. New York has to bail out Arkansas on a permanent level. I mean, nobody talks about it. It's just in the federal budget. But it's happening all the time. And that's what you need. And if you have such a large currency area and the framers of the European Union, these people are not fools. They know this. And they created this monetary union knowing that that this would happen. And they want to foist fiscal union upon the European Union. And nobody wants this here because the Dutch and the Germans and the Finnish and everybody wants to maintain control of their own budgets. But this monetary union creates a dynamic that sort of forces their hand. And now it's either the euro and fiscal union or an implosion of the European Union with all the problems that that entails. And this is how the European Union was created, and this is going on today.
With the European Union, I think the banking system is sort of the driving force behind a lot of this globalization.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
the bank,
absolutely.
Paul Craig Roberts sort of mentioned, I'm not sure if he subscribes to Austrian economics, but he did say something interesting, that they orchestrated the job outsourcing.
The international banking fraternity.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's quite clear. I mean, one of the European Union and its euro crisis is a very important dynamic that was created by the bankers. And the other issue, of course, is the United States. And the United States is even today, even though it's a behemoth on that is now, well, it's massively overextended and it's basically ready to be decapitated, but it's still the last major national power that is standing. And by outsourcing the manufacturing base of the United States to basically China, they have destroyed the United States has always been, or has been since the early 20th century, the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. And especially after the Second World War, they were completely dominant. And by outsourcing this this manufacturing base to China, this source of power has been relinquished, and this has been done knowing what was going on. Of course, I mean these people are not stupid, and they know exactly what they're doing. And the American people are stupid, just like the European peoples are stupid, but the international bankers are not, and the political elite of both the EU and the United States are not, and they know exactly what they're doing.
We're out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that what we discussed was quite fascinating, and basically discussed everything that I write about on my site, realcurrencies.wordpress.com, and I thank you for it.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for tonight, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.